Okay, we're here with the authors of City Time, David Campbell and Jared Shanahan. Thanks for joining us.
What's up? Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure.
So we've had, Jared, we've had you on when your book Captives came out, and this is your second book about Rikers, and you're joined with a fellow ex-resident of Rikers, David Campbell. Do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself, David?
Yeah, I'm a writer and translator primarily. I served a year on Rikers Island. I wrote a book about the social world of sentenced men at Rikers Island with the Honorable Jared Shanahan, present with us today, as you know.
And how did you two meet? You did not meet at Rikers, but
no, we served our sentences a few years apart. We were put in touch by mutual friends when I was facing my charges, and it was looking increasingly probable that I would have to do some time. I was not thrilled about that, and my friends and comrades, especially those on my defense committee, were putting me in touch with people who had served time for cases related to political activism. And Jared was one of them.
You mentioned the four questions that everybody asks when you're in there.
What are you in for?
Yeah. What are you in for? Let's go through that. What are you in for, David?
What am I in for?
Yeah.
I'm in for assault.
Okay. You want to go into that?
Sure. Yeah. I don't mind. No, I was arrested in an anti-fascist protest, and they hit me with the gang assault law, which is a pretty crazy law that it's created during the Giuliani Pataki era. Basically to make it really easy for them to lock up groups of primarily black and brown working class young men. If there are three or more of you and you're involved in a fight, then you're a gang legally, and you're all responsible for each other's actions. So if the three of us get into a street fight with some dude, and like you, Andy, decide that it's time to start stabbing the guy, and you stab him because, I don't know, you're just that crazy, and I'm the one who gets arrested, I could legally be convicted of stabbing the guy, right? Because we're all responsible for each other's actions. Mm-hmm. So, and that's a 3.5-year mandatory minimum. You know, they threw a bunch of other stuff at me because I was indeed the only person arrested at this particular protest. And it, like 95% of other people who are facing criminal charges, right, became clear to me that I should probably just take the least bad plea I could get that didn't involve cooperating with the prosecution and just like do as short a sentence as I could and get on with my life.
And so how much time did you end up serving?
I did 12 months on an 18-month sentence. Mm. So I had 6 months reduced for good behavior. Yeah.
And Jared did a bit less time, if I'm not mistaken. It's not a competition, but you did about a month.
No, he won by that measure. He got less time than me. That's great.
That's correct.
And so how did you two hook up and start writing together?
Well, we started just talking about what life was like for sentenced men on Rikers Island. 90% of the people on Rikers are not sentenced. They're pretrial detainees. They're in on minor parole violations, or they are sentenced to prison time upstate, and they're awaiting transfer upstate. The other 10% of people on Rikers are serving short sentences, about a year, 16 months max. So as you can imagine, it's a very specific sort of like psychological and cultural environment for those men who are going to see the street again very soon. We just started talking about that and how particular it was, because I was trying to research the space I was going to go into in all probability. And, you know, if you look up things about Rikers, it's going to be like, yeah, it's crazy. Everyone's killing each other all the time or whatever, right? And like, that's one, not true, but generally that stuff comes from the world of pretrial detainees, because that's 90% of the island's population, right? So Jared and I had some very fruitful discussions about what daily life was actually like for sentenced men. I was recommended by a member of my defense committee to start chronicling that and kind of taking notes as a participant observer, you know, to create some distance between myself and the world around me and try to understand it. Before I went in, I started doing that. We were comparing notes, differences between my sentence in 2019 and his in 2016. And I was doing some reading, getting educated on the history of mass incarceration, Rikers, etc. And yeah, ultimately, we said it would be a real shame if we didn't do something with all of this.
Yeah, when I first encountered David, a friend of mine from the old insurrectionary anarchist scene and I were looking at the newspaper, and there was a big picture of David getting arrested. And my buddy was like, man, glad I wasn't rolling with that guy. And I was like, ha, 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 better you than me, asshole. And then shortly thereafter, I was put in touch with him. And he's a perfectly, perfectly agreeable guy. I really like working with him. And we it's a true story.
Yeah. No, I like do not resent you at all for having the better you than me asshole reaction, because I've had it multiple times since.
It's like, yep, man, your journey's just beginning.
Yeah.
But something that we took seriously from the beginning was there is this social process of people, and it's certainly not limited to activist spaces, but of people who know they're going to have to get locked up, seeking out and finding, you know, advice and kind of pithy kind of folk wisdom. And we found this not just between friends and political networks, but within people in the institution. So when I was waiting in line at 100 Center Street on the day that I was pretty sure that I was going to have to go in, and struck up a conversation with the guy behind me in line. And he was like, oh, yeah, I go there all the time. Just don't look at the clock. Don't look at the calendar. And there's all
good advice. I mean,
yeah, just don't obsess about the time. Just find something to immerse yourself in, and it'll be over before you know it. And this kind of socializing, coping strategies, it's a kind of, like, you know, to use some buzzwords, it's like mutual aid and care practiced throughout these institutions. And like, it's a shame that like the kind of people, like, you know, white middle class folks who like write books about care and mutual aid and stuff think that they fucking invented it or something. But it's like these practices are very common among people on some of the lowest rungs of the social ladder, and we found that pretty much immediately when we were both locked up.
Totally. It's a lot. Like, it's a lot to handle, you know, and people who deal with incarceration all the time understand that and take care of each other.
Yeah. And so my first impression of the book was that it was a very comprehensive answer to the question that you often have got, which is like, what was it like? And so this book tells it in every detail that I could possibly think to ask. So you'll never have to answer that question again, I assume. But then also it struck me that maybe this would be a resource for somebody who was facing time at Rikers. Like, because there's like blueprints of where you're going to stay and like what you're going to wear and what you're going to eat and what kind of people you're going to encounter. And were you thinking of it in that way too, as something that could help people who are for facing time?
No, it wasn't one of the original ideas, but I'm glad that, because you're not the first person to say that, actually. I'm glad that seems to be something that jumps out at people. It's like, you could use this as a preparatory manual for serving a short sentence on Rikers.
Yeah, but the thing is, if we said that it was a guide for reading to people who are like planning to go to Rikers, then people might buy it and read it.
And we wouldn't want that now, would we?
So we've decided to say that it's an academic press ethnography, so
to stave off sales at all costs.
Yeah, well, I'm just really concerned about never selling out.
Yeah, really worried about that too.
It's an ethnography of yourselves too, because you talk, it's like in the third person about these two guys, Jared and David.
Which who are us? Yeah, someone asked me that last night. I was like, I don't know, man. If you say we, but then, you know, in a given incident, it's not both of us that experienced it. It's like very strange. And then if it's like I, but then it switches back. I wrote the day in the life chapter in the second person originally, you know, you, but that was kind of weird because, you know, I mean, not everyone's going to have the same experience at Rikers, you know, not everyone's day in the life is going to be the same, depending on who they are.
Yeah. And it's a particular method called participant observer ethnography. Right. What that means is that you are chronicling this social world and you're representing it as systematically as possible. So it's not a memoir. This is not like a splashy tell-all, like D-Rock and J-Dog's Guide to Doing Hard Time. You know, this is like, it's a fairly sober, systematic extrapolation of the social world that we found behind bars. And it's called a participant observer because we were participating in the world at the same time as we were documenting it. And this is actually a really cool methodology. If you're interested in writing, like, let's say about a social movement that you were a part of, and you don't want to write a memoir, you don't want to write just some kind of celebration of the movement that takes all of its slogans and, you know, declares victory even when there wasn't one, you know, there's a way to write about something faithfully and respectfully, with a more sober kind of even-handed methodology, even when you were a part of that phenomenon. So if you read the book, David said this, Jared did that, right? And that's how we narrate the book. So we're honest about the fact that most of the empirical information comes from our own experiences. And we're very careful at the beginning of the book to say, like, we're not talking about the experience of being sentenced to Rikers or the experience of prisoners, right? We make no such grandiose claims, but within the limits of our own kind of empirical experiences, what can we say about this world? And that's kind of the method.
One question came to mind, sort of contemporaneous with what's going on in California with the wildfires, was the topic of obviously the daily disrespect that you receive and like the uncertainty and confusion and just like sort of black hole of life that you have when you're in there. And then also on top of that, the boredom of just trying to figure out how to pass time. And that's kind of part of the punishment. What were you thinking when you saw a discourse about the 30% of California firefighters who are incarcerated people? Obviously, I think it sort of went through this wave of like, at first people were decrying this as this horrible thing. And then when some more interviews of the firefighters came out, people thought, well, maybe this is actually a good program, although it's not preparing people for like a job. A lot of them seemed to like it better than being locked up.
Yeah, I mean, I tell you what, it's not boring. Like, I've never been a firefighter in California or elsewhere. But if I, you know, I mean, the city time inmates on Rikers Island don't bury the dead on Hard Island anymore, right? Mm-hmm. But they did for years. And people loved that job. They loved to get out of the dorm, get shackled together, get put on a ferry, get transferred over to Hard Island, and spend the day digging mass graves for people who were too poor to afford their own funerals. And that was just a blast for these people. I mean, that was a really good job. I mean, I'm overstating it a little bit, right? Like, you know, it's a jail job, right? And it doesn't sound like really fulfilling, but you're working with your hands, you're getting outside, you're doing something that like has some social use, you know, has some societal use, right? And I've heard a lot of the same sort of comments made by the people who are the prisoners who are fighting fires in California. So, yeah, I mean, like, it sure isn't boring, right? And it's something that has real value for society. It's a damn shame that doesn't transfer to, you know, their life after release. Like, they're not going to be able to get a job as a firefighter or whatever.
Mm-hmm. That's the real issue, too. Yeah. If anyone's interested in reading more about the California firefighters, my friend, the prison scholar Abby Cuniff, has done a number of interesting studies. Some of it has appeared on the website Truth Out, and Abby's writing a lot of like about the history of the fire camp program and how it came to be. The kind of environmental catastrophe intersected with like the human catastrophe of mass incarceration and deindustrialization and all the rest of it. I think in the case of Rikers Island, we have a whole chapter on work and how incarcerated people relate to their jobs. And I think David was right on the money in what he just said. You know, there's a lot of unfortunate canards about mass incarceration that you hear even from well-meaning activist folks. Like, you'll hear things like, oh, well, prisons replaced slavery because they, which is always this kind of nefarious force, needed the free labor to continue. And so that's why we have prisons. Prisons exist because there are commodities produced in them that are then sold at the market, on the market for a profit, right? Which is just simply not true. In 99% of the cases of incarceration, there's a few thousand out of millions. There's a few thousand prisoners in the United States who labor in manufacturing for corporations that sell their commodities on the open market.
So it's about 3% of the total incarcerated population, I believe. And private prisons are about 8%.
So like, yes, so
it's not a profitable industry.
It's a red herring, and it actually stands in the way of understanding the more complex way that incarceration relates to the labor market. When you look at prison labor, as we did, from the perspective of the people who are actually working these jobs, right, rather than taking some grand historical theory that you saw in the movie 13th or something, you find that people, generally speaking, you know, enjoy these jobs that are very much reproducing the facility itself. There's not a lot of manufacture. There's no manufacturer at Rikers Island that I ever encountered.
No, there's no. All that stuff comes from upstate. Like all the clothes are made
by
Corecraft.
The hand sanitizer.
Yeah, hand sanitizer, the soap, the uniforms are all made by Corecraft, which is a corporation owned by the New York State Department of Correction. And the upstate prisons produce goods that are then used in prisons. I think they produce some other stuff that's used, like, you know, lockers and license plates or stuff, you know, stuff like that.
And but those are produced for public agencies.
For public agencies. I think the bulk of the stuff that Corecraft produces, they have a website with their catalog, like, publicly available. Most of it's stuff that's for use in prison and for incarcerated people.
And this is, and I want to finish this and be very careful with what I'm trying to say here, which is, it is true that incarcerated people and the people that we met, right, generally speaking, very much enjoyed their jobs. Not because they paid well, right? Very much the opposite. But because they provided a little bit of freedom, a little bit of self-determination, the ability to move more freely throughout the facility, the ability to engage in some kind of daily work that you can identify with, whether it's, you know, painting a wall, digging a hole. If you've ever had a labor job, you probably know what I mean. There's a way that you can kind of metabolize with your labor and feel good about it, right? And this does not mean that everybody behind bars should have a job. What this does mean is that these guys should not be behind bars. Right. What they're looking for, and you know, on the outside, is a way to be socially useful and a way to plug in to a society. And the guys that we were locked up with were people who had generally been foreclosed from any kind of meaningful participation in society. And, you know, and if that was done justly, then they would just be antisocial behind bars. But what we encountered was that people desperately wanted to live in some kind of organized social world and to take part in its, you know, production and reproduction.
To feel that they're agents, you know, contributing meaningfully to that society. I want to add two more points to that. We cite a French prison ethnographer named Fabrice Guilbeault, who studied how work factored into the routines of prisoners in French short stay prisons. So it's actually a pretty similar population to those serving city time on Rikers, short sentences and what's comparable to a jail. And he found that, contrary to Goffman's kind of theory, that all incarcerated time is just this like monotonous pile of dead time that you have to work through. Like, that's certainly true. The idea that, or like the feeling among incarcerated people, that this time is like a burden. It's kind of stolen from your like real life or your life outside in the world. It's not unvarying, and there's actually some fluctuations in it. And when you go to work, time goes faster. This is like a truism among prisoners on Rikers for sure. Like, people say that all the time. You got to get out of the dorm, and when you work, time goes fast. Like, those are things that people say almost always together, right? And also, Guilbeault points out that when you work, you're able to inhabit this role of, like, you know, I worked in the kitchen on Rikers, right? So like, I got to be a guy who helped like get the food to other people, and it was kind of like being a line cook, but in a really shitty way, because I had a guard like looking at me, telling me to like put that hotel pan in that thing, or, you know, like, yeah. It's not great, but at least I'm not just a prisoner, right?
Yeah, it wasn't Food Not Bombs, but, you know, you were feeding your...
I was working
on
a project.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, cool. So let's get into the book a little bit. We'll have you read some sections of it. And all right, where do you think you'd like to begin?
We've been flipping to random pages for all of our readings, so.
Go for it.
You want to do that?
Yeah, it's worked so far.
So this is, it's my attempt to induct City Time into the illustrious Pick Any Page Club, which is a distinction afforded to a book that you can just open up to any page and you're going to read something that's crazy, bizarre,
like the phenomenology of the spirit,
outrageous. Yeah. I think the best Rikers book in the Pick Any Page Club is, of course, The Almighty Corruption Officer by Big Gary Hayward, chronicling his descent from a guard of Rikers into a prisoner himself through a scarcely believable tale of corruption and all kinds of hijinks. And you can just flip to any page in that book, and it's the craziest shit you've ever read in your life. And so we kind of aspire to that with City Time. So are you, you found a random page, David? Are you ready?
I found a random page. It's in the chapter entitled Doing Time, which kind of chronicles different time strategies time doing strategies. It's a term used by John Irwin. He's kind of the prison ethnographer who founded the field of convict criminology. Incarcerated, or formerly incarcerated people studying the conditions of their incarceration. And it's right at the end. It's about one's last day. It is generally agreed that last day drags on eternally. Victor Serge called the final hours of his incarceration, quote, perhaps the most endless of my life. David's last day went more quickly than anticipated, but there was an unexpected two-hour delay before his being told to get ready to be escorted to the intake pens for release, and the actual arrival of the escort CO. David spent this time trying to read a book, but the words seemed to blur on the page, his mouth dry, his pulse racing, the second hand on the clock mired in unseen molasses. A central fixture of how inmates relate to their impending release is what Goffman calls the release binge fantasy, the frequently discussed plans for great excesses in the outside world, often framed as making up for loss or rewarding oneself. These fantasies can take different forms. Future sex with women is a major theme in City Time discussions, which, statistically speaking, include a number of men who do not actually enjoy it or plan to do it upon release. Groups of boosters or professional shoplifters often compare notes on the best places to expropriate the most valuable goods with minimum risk upon release. After a stretch of city time comparing notes with other boosters akin to professional development training, they prepare to return to the outside world energized and ready to get back to work. But the main theme of release binge fantasies is getting high. Inmates discourse endlessly on how high they will get and stay upon release. Quote, like hungry men who can talk about nothing but food, in the words of seasoned detainee and self-identified junkie William S. Burroughs. While the discussion is typically framed around marijuana, at least in larger discussion circles where hard drug users are looked down upon, weed surely functions for some as a metonym for drugs like crack and heroin. And in many cases, the binge is not a fantasy. As former Rikers health official Homer Venters writes, the likelihood of a drug-addicted person overdosing increases significantly following that person's release from jail. Those who do not overdose are likely to re-immerse themselves in a familiar cycle of drug use, petty crime, and ultimately spending more time on Rikers. David personally witnessed multiple inmates with addiction problems be released only to return months later for possession or other drug-related crimes. Jared heard anecdotes of COs telling released inmates that their jail job would be waiting for them when they returned. It is tragic confirmation that many of these men are, as a common cliche in the system runs, serving, quote, life sentences on the installment plan. Some bullshit. Given the disproportionate infusion of police and courts into working class communities of color in New York City, many ordinary men with no aspirations to a life of crime wind up in the meshes of the city's punishment system. Some of these men may experiment with the, quote, about that life identity, but many just wish to get through their time, return to their lives, and forget all about their city time. These men do not celebrate crime or their forays into criminalization. When they are asked what they are in for, a common refrain is, some bullshit. The inmates in for some bullshit are testaments to the racial and class biases of the punishment system. They are men of color locked up for things that we could not imagine a white person, especially of means, doing jail time for. Some of these are drug charges involving possession or sale that do not underlie a glorified life of crime identity. After all, plenty of people outside of that lifestyle use and distribute drugs. But young, working-class black and brown men are far more likely to be stopped and searched, whether on foot or while driving. Others are even more tragic. Jared bunked next to a young Latino man who had assisted his cousin in transporting a television that turned out to be stolen. David worked alongside an undocumented Guatemalan immigrant who had been arrested twice for driving without a license, then fled the state. This is not to say that these men were faultless in the eyes of the law, but it is to say that many of these would have resulted in instant probation, especially for first-time arrestees in the white worlds that David and Jared hail from. These men were largely familiar with the social world of the gangbanger, having grown up in communities where these subjectivities and forms of organization are common. They would make sure to distinguish themselves as streetwise and not to be messed with, but they were not chasing after gang status or glory in the social world of the jail. To whatever extent they represented street culture, It was to get themselves enough respect to not be preyed upon, and maybe enjoy some of the perks that come with familiarity with powerful cliques, like access to contraband. These men spoke of eagerly returning to their law-abiding lives as blue-collar workers or entrepreneurs, and were decidedly not about that life. The some bullshit inmates' careful negotiation of proximity to gang culture and their studied removal from active participation was in all likelihood a dance they had long cultivated on the outside. Hooch and other drugs. Hooch is usually an opaque yellow-orange or red-orange slurry with a trademark funky vinegar smell and tart grapefruit-like taste. It is made primarily from oranges, but often sweetened with stolen white sugar or the sugar-free powdered juice packets sold at commissary. Hooch is also sometimes made more potent by the addition of any number of prescription drugs from the clinic when available. Hooch is available only intermittently, as it takes 2 to 3 weeks to make, during which time it may be confiscated on a search, or if stashed somewhere outside the dorm, such as the hooch maker's workplace, discovered and enjoyed by other inmates. Ready batches of hooch also tend to disappear quickly, as people are eager for its intoxicating effects. The ever-present fear of losing one's hooch to a random search also drives rapid consumption. A batch may be consumed in only a day or two. Though it is often shared with friends free of charge, it is usually sold by the bottle at a premium to those further socially removed from those who produce it. Hooch is usually consumed during the daytime. Inmates have nowhere to go and little to occupy their minds, and it is all but impossible to enjoy any sort of secondary activity while imbibing, like watching TV after lights out, when the dorm is dark and the day room closed. This, coupled with the greater likelihood of creating conflict by getting drunk and belligerent while others are trying to sleep at night, means most hooch drinkers do so in broad daylight, often starting as soon as they wake up in the morning and shuffling through the day in a drunken haze until they fall asleep mid-afternoon. Their consumption is often oddly public. Hooch is usually kept in reused clear plastic bottles and is therefore very easy to identify with its distinct cloudy yellowish color. But most COs and even some captains choose to ignore the drink's consumption completely. On several occasions, David witnessed men talking on the phone, sipping from bottles of hooch as they did, even as a captain made rounds in the dorm. The inmates know which DOC staff actually care about hooch and simply keep it out of their sight.
Interpersonal relationships. During David's time, an inmate called Ak purchased a bowl from another, Shapi, and paid him in packets of tuna. This was a transaction so quotidian it would normally have been unremarkable. But Chapin had been periodically complaining of food missing from his bucket for some time, the sure sign of a sneak thief at work. To discourage the thief and recuperate his items if stolen, he had begun carefully writing a number on the bottom of each of his commissary food items in black ballpoint pen. One of the packets of tuna that Ak paid him with had a 5 carefully written on the silvery bottom of the packaging. Chapin called Ak out on this shortly after the sale. Ak, sputtering, vehemently denied it and tore the lid off his bucket to show how full it was. "Why would I steal," he said, "when my bucket is full? Why would I pay you with the same tuna if I stole it?" Chapin challenged Ak to explain where he got the tuna. Ak said he got it from Walid, whose bed sat between them. Walid also denied the theft and opened his bucket to prove that he was also jail wealthy enough to not need to steal. One of the men who had gathered around to watch the conflict then brought it to the attention of the shot callers, who were playing spades in the day room. "We can't let this shit go," one announced. "It'll just get worse." There was no talk of how punishing the wrong man might embolden the actual thief by giving others a false sense of security, nor of the moral issues of punishing an innocent person. Another shot caller entered the day room. "Yo, somebody's stealing out of our buckets," said one of the card players. "Who?" he asked. "Walid." said one of the card players, definitively, as if he knew. The shot caller's face darkened, and he rushed angrily over to Waleed, loudly and aggressively confronting him about the stolen tuna. Waleed kept his cool. "All that proves," he said, "is that someone stole it from Shapin and lost it gambling to me." But it didn't matter. The decision had been made based on rumor and personal preference alone. One of the shot callers threw an empty trash bag at Waleed. The rank-and-file gang members who were now lurking in the background, crossing their arms, their mere presence a threat of force. "One way or another, bro," a shot caller said, pounding a meaty fist into a fleshy palm to accentuate his words, "you gotta go." Waleed sighed and grabbed the bag. He knew he had no choice but to pack up. As we have seen, the majority of the rules inmates follow are not written in any book, and most transgressions one can commit are not in violation of any institutional statute. Instead, a complex and often ad hoc inmate code structures social life in countless ways, which may be invisible to the new arrival, but which must be discerned and observed quickly to avoid dangerous conflict, even if the inmates privately resist internalizing them. As Lil Wayne put it in his C-76 diary, "It's crazy how jail can make doing what you wouldn't regularly do make sense. I'll have to be mindful not to get lost in this opposite world." While these codes are nuanced and contingent on a number of local variables, like the power structure of the dormitory and the give and take between inmates and COs, they serve two distinct and sometimes contradictory functions. First, the customs governing city time houses are designed to create a kind of, quote, surface order, which is the outward appearance of a smoothly running jail. This enables a number of transgressions like smoking and contraband exchange to occur, without constituting a direct affront to the power of the COs. Second, and often to the contrary, some inmate customs, especially derived from the codes of gang life, call for violence that breaks this surface order and risks bringing unwanted CO attention down on the dormitory, including invasive searches that turn up all manner of contraband. Gangs, for instance, explicitly mandate solidarity among members, creating a code that compels men who might otherwise be reluctant into dangerous situations to either back up a comrade under assault or else avenge an attack from the past. Beyond gang codes, the ordinary codes of masculinity force inmates to avenge any affront to their manliness, however slight, which can lead to violence. Thus, while disturbances that could potentially bring scrutiny and collective penalties down on all inmates are generally frowned upon, the same system of de facto rules that discourages this behavior sometimes commands it. Similarly, those at the top of the hierarchy, the shot callers, who have secured a measure of relief from degradation, in the words of sociologist Richard Cloward, may be pushed into calling for or even ordering revolt if they feel the institution is failing to respect the arrangement that affords them a modicum of decency. Such was the case when David's dorm organized a strike, along with the neighboring dorms, to protest unsafe conditions under COVID-19. While the strike was organized non-hierarchically in David's dorm, the action was initiated in the neighboring unit by those at the top of the gang hierarchy. Without their support, organizing would have been difficult and potentially dangerous. Beneath any organized or even coherent structure of de facto or de jure rules, we saw at Rikers lay simply the reality of adult men forced to share space with little to no privacy and few means of escape from an enforced proximity to dozens of other people in the same situation. As sociologist Loic Wacant observed in the Men's Central Jail in Los Angeles, Sartre's sentence, "Hell is other people," is truer here than anywhere else. Inmates must negotiate forced exposure to people they might not ordinarily associate with, and may harbor suspicions or hostility toward. Anthropologist and novelist Alison Spedding describes experiencing this, quote, "bizarre community, which is not a community," quote,
while incarcerated at a women's jail in Bolivia. Spedding writes, "We spend every day in intimate contact, but the only thing we have in common is the repeated cry of, 'I want to get out.'" One man incarcerated at Rikers in 2020 put it more bluntly, "We have a common interest to get the fuck up out here as soon as possible." It is a climate suffused with what ethnographer Michael Walker calls, quote, conflict energy, meaning, quote, charged up inner subjectivity and emotional energy toward potential conflict. In such a setting, the most mundane actions can provoke violence, or more commonly, a general state of constant, grating, simmering annoyance. "I wish that dude would shut the fuck up," writes Lil Wayne. "Damn, jailhouse communication is the worst shit ever. And to make matters worse, they repeat everything twice. Like, hey, them guys down there be bugging. Them guys be bugging. That's my word. That's my word, son." "I don't know if it's a jailhouse thing," Wayne wonders, "a New York thing, or a New York jailhouse thing, but it's for damn sure an annoying as fuck thing." A person who has not experienced this degree of forced proximity may have a difficult time grasping how frustrating and humiliating it can be to be deprived of any privacy at all, day in, day out, from the most vulnerable and potentially embarrassing moments of daily life, especially bodily functions like defecation, through banalities like reading the newspaper, daydreaming, or simply wanting to be alone. Both David and Jared, for instance, covet sustained silent time for reading and writing, and struggled with their resentment of inmates who casually interrupted this. To avoid unnecessary conflict and to cultivate necessary social ties, we had to work on masking how utterly apoplectic casual interruptions made us. Life in city time dormitories is a constant and obligatory social affair, far in excess of what most people experience on the outside. This inescapable presence of others, even at their least offensive, is a ceaseless, dull irritation, always threatening to explode. Much attention, then, is paid to the minutiae of interpersonal relations and how to keep things running as painlessly as possible. Despite the appearance of chaos, the social life of city time is as structured an affair as you can find just about anywhere else. What to do and how to do it. Among themselves, writes incarcerated author Jack Henry Abbott, guards are human. Among themselves, prisoners are human. Yet between these two, the relationship is not human. It is animal. Put a bit less dramatically, in the words of former C-76 inmate Neville Storm Red, "I have to get up day after day and look at someone every day, having them telling me when I can sleep, eat, or shit. And Storm don't like people telling him what to do and how to do it." Despite the animosity built into their opposing subject positions, however, city time inmates are NCOs are stuck with each other, and the functioning of the jail requires some degree of their cooperation. This means that within what we might call a low-intensity social war, some modicum of cooperation must be eked out. The most stubborn fact of relations between COs and inmates is that underneath the uniforms that aim, quite overtly, to definitively establish and enforce their very different social roles, everyone is a human being. In undertaking their duties, COs demonstrate considerable variance in their individual personalities, levels of sympathy or antipathy toward the inmates, or enforcement of the jail's rules, or lack thereof. But at the end of the day, with no respect to their individuality, the COs have a job to do, one that puts them at odds with the inmate. "For the custodian, control is the central interest," writes sociologist Richard Cloward. "For the inmate, escape from the material and social deprivation." End quote. We can surmise that even the COs who smuggle contraband or otherwise break the law with select inmates spend most of their time enforcing the institution's rules in the interest of preserving the appearance of normality, a especially if they are concerned with avoiding detection. Relations between inmates and COs therefore assume the paradox inherent in many hierarchical institutions, where people interact with each other as both human beings and representatives of the structural position they have been assigned. While these roles might be relaxed when things are going well, any slackening of the jail's rigid inmate-CO division will not last long. When an inmate in Jared's dormitory, who had been exchanging flirtations with a female CO, purchased her a sweet treat from the commissary as a gift, one of Jared's section mates remarked in disgust, "What kind of a motherfucker goes to commissary and gets something for a CO?" "She got a helmet upstairs," he continued, referring to the CO's riot gear, "and she gonna put it on and bust your head."
In-person visits. "Open mouth," drones the CO. "Show hands." Inmates file by, flashing their palms and opening wide to demonstrate that they are not holding any contraband as they enter the visitation area. At C-76, visits take place in a large disused gymnasium, commonly called the dance hall or the dance floor. It features a cluster of the same plastic chairs found throughout the facility. There is a small area for children to play in, and a cage in the corner where inmates denied contact visits can shout to their loved ones through holes drilled in plexiglass. Otherwise, inmates are able to sit close to their friends and family, though COs patrol the floor to prevent overly sexual touching or the transfer of contraband. We received regular pre-visit warnings, like the following de facto guidelines Jared received for visiting an intimate partner. Kiss, squeeze the booty once, don't play with the titties, don't try to finger bang, and if you a homo, no grabbing the wiener. If I see you making out too much, I'll pull you off the floor to inspect your mouth. The clock will keep running, and it will take me as long as it takes. That's my way of being a dick. As any visitor can attest, writes former Rikers writing teacher Jennifer Wynn, penetrating Rikers Island is a punishing experience. Before COVID-19, in-person visits were allowed throughout the week, though eligibility varied for inmates based on where their last names fell in the alphabet. For instance, some weeks, inmates with the last names beginning with the letters A through L are allowed visits on Thursday and Sunday, and those beginning with the letters M through Z on Wednesday and Saturday, with Friday open to all, and the visitation area closed Monday and Tuesday. But this was constantly changing, and visitors had to stay on top of the schedule. Visits are 1 hour long, and allowed from roughly 1 p.m. to 9 p.m. on weekdays and 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. on weekends. Visitors are required to complete registration 1 hour before closing. They can apply for two-hour visits if they have traveled a considerable distance. In Rikers folk wisdom, this means anywhere outside the five boroughs. But this is up to the COs, and if granted, long visits can still be terminated at their discretion. Detainees awaiting trial in Rikers are entitled to 3 visits per week, while sentenced visit inmates serving city time are allowed 2. All prisoners' visits are limited to 1 per day and can include up to 3 visitors. During our sentences, visitors could bring permitted personal items like socks, underwear, or books, and inmates could receive them from COs at the end of their visit. Visits, often called VIs, represent a key lifeline to the outside world and are often a precious thread holding together families and romantic partnerships. Just as visits bridge the inmate to the outside world, they insert the outsider into the social world of the jail. The process is accordingly arduous for the visitor. Even getting to the foot of the Rikers Island Bridge can take upwards of 2 hours via public transportation from neighborhoods like Flatbush and East New York, which account for a disproportionate share of Rikers prisoners. From there, visitors must pay a fare to be ferried across the bridge by the Q100 bus, their only way across. Intake in the island's visitor center, and then again at the jail itself, is akin to going through an airline checkpoint multiple times in a row,
including an invasive search long criticized by visitors as targeting women for unwarranted strip searches. In 2019, a federal judge concurred and ordered the city to pay $1.25 million to complainants in a class action lawsuit. This treatment is symptomatic of a process in which inmates' loved ones are treated with all the verbal abuse and disrespect COs mete out to inmates themselves, a fact observed by both David's and Jared's visitors. Interestingly, when David was moved to C-74, a number of visitors commented that the COs were more polite than those in C-76. One prominent theory ran that the adolescent prisoners who were a majority there, known for their recalcitrance and willingness to fight when disrespected, forced the COs to be nicer. In both facilities, however, visitors are menaced and humiliated as potential smugglers of contraband. In the Rikers Visitation zine Visiting Day, Queens zinester and artist Maud Pryor describes her bus being boarded by a CO with a drug-sniffing dog. When a visitor objected to the dog coming too close to him, he was singled out for a special search in retaliation. Inside, the walls are plastered with stomach-churning photographs of gaping face wounds in full view of children, meant to supposedly shame would-be weapons smugglers. The Correction Officers Benevolent Association has long insisted that contraband comes primarily through the visiting area and should be blamed on inmates and their families. COs, however, are routinely apprehended smuggling all manner of contraband into Rikers. The ease with which Rikers COs can smuggle contraband and the widespread nature of the practice was documented in a dramatic fashion by former CO Gary Hayward's 2015 memoir Corruption Officer, which details Hayward's own adventures in smuggling that culminated in his 2006 arrest. Corroborating much of Hayward's account a decade later, the New York City Department of Investigation tested the island's security protocol in 2016, demonstrating the ease with which COs could smuggle high volumes of contraband, including drugs, alcohol, and a razor blade. A 2018 follow-up found the island had not done much to fix the deficiencies outlined in 2016. And if, as COBA insists, the visitation area is in fact the primary source of contraband, it remains difficult to explain how, during David's time, when visits were suspended due to COVID-19, the amount of contraband circulating on Rikers actually increased. These facts do not matter in the visitation process, as the visitor suffers from a presupposition of guilt.
I just wanted to make a video giving everybody an update of the things that have been going on in my life. I know a lot of people were concerned about me going to jail, so my life here is pretty good. I've been making a lot of friends, and I've been exercising and writing a lot. This is my cellmate, and she got this phone into jail and let me log into my Instagram account on it.
You're doing a motherfucking vlog?
I'm gonna post it on Instagram.
So this guy is William Banks. He is an alt comedian. He got a he was locked up for, I think, destroying a few like pro-Israel posters that were in his neighborhood in Connecticut.
Okay.
And I think he got like a month for each poster, so he's doing like 5 months.
How did they calculate that? Whatever.
I haven't looked too much into his case, but I think that's the story. And so his cellmate, I guess, has a phone smuggled in, or maybe they're allowed to have a phone. I can't imagine it, but
I think it's probably smuggled.
So he's just posting Instagram reels from prison, and he's still doing, I think, like a combination of his real life and this sort of alt comedy character he has. Here's him on Christmas.
It's almost Christmas time, and in the jail, we're not able to have a real Christmas tree in our cell, but we do have this printed out picture of the Christmas tree.
All right.
Let me take you next to it. Will you stand next to it?
No.
please.
Nigga, you stand next to her. Come on. And smile. Smile, nigga.
Merry Christmas.
And then some of them he gets into incredible. These little fights that I think are not real fights.
For Christmas, I got you a Christmas cookie.
Oh.
So he's just doing bits here in jail.
Yeah, I think that's wonderful.
Yeah, it's definitely a different version of jail than you normally get, where you just have to fight all the time and like it's just terrifying. This guy's doing Nathan Fielder comedy.
Yeah, jail. I mean, he apparently did get his ass kicked for suggesting that they celebrate Christmas, but that's pretty much par for the course. Jared, you had an anecdote about a stand-up comedian during your incarceration that appears in our book.
Oh, I went to a comedy show at Rikers. And it's a bit like my high school, like, humiliation nightmare. But it really happened, and I knew what I was getting into because I was the only white guy in this very large dormitory. And the comedian's just, like, looking around for who to roast. And he picks out this old guy. It's like 70 years old or something. And he did an impression of him trying to run away from the police. Everybody found that really funny, and you know, he noticed me, and then it was just over. I got roasted pretty bad.
That's the rest of his tight five right there.
That was your punishment. That was your real punishment. Yeah, to get roasted.
It's true, actually.
Would you care to relate some of the jibes he threw your way?
I mean, like most stand-up comedy, it didn't really make any fucking sense, but he got me good for saying that I was probably in there to piss off my parents. And he said that I was probably a Hannibal Lecter people-eating motherfucker. Kind of riffed on that one for a little while. So I was a people-eating.
There's a lot of like conventional wisdom that holds that, like, you know, a white guy who looks like me or Jared and kind of carries himself and talks like me or Jared has probably done something horrible to end up in jail.
Mm.
So
yeah, I was like, man, what the fuck did you do to get in here? It was like a curiosity. Mm-hmm. So I knew what was going to happen when I went to the comedy show, but it was a nice time.
Yeah, you're very brave.
Not very bored.
Did you see some people with cell phones in there, like Instagramming and stuff?
No.
It was pretty tightly controlled where we were. I think that is partly a function of city time. Yeah.
No one's going to smuggle a cell phone into city time.
Detainees occasionally had phones. That was something that people talked about. I mean, but city time, you know what I mean? Like, I never saw a phone, never heard of a phone, you know?
I mean, half those guys probably didn't have phones on the outside.
It's totally true.
Listen, these are not the big timers that we were locked up with. Yeah.
Not like William Banks.
Exactly.
No. All right. Thanks for sharing the book with us. The book is City Time. You're on tour now, but the tour is drawing to an end. It'll probably be over by the time this comes out. So where can people check out your work and the book?
NYUpress.org.com on the NYU Press website.
If you're in Chicago, go to Pilsen Community Books. If you're in Sayville, go to the Tiny Raccoon. If you're anywhere else, click onto the World Wide Web. Go fire up Google, type in City Time.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks.